yourself a song to sing, and sing it till you're done. Yeah, sing it hard and sing it well. Send the robber barons straight to hell. The greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything they found, whose crimes have gone unpunished now, walk the streets a screaming now. Your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Okay, today we've got a couple guests, and we're going to continue our giving coverage to emerging independent third-party organizations and candidates. I said a couple weeks ago we were going to do that, and we have another group here today who are going to speak and let us know something about their organization and what they're doing, what they're planning to do, strategy, tactics, analysis of the situation, etc. But before I introduce my two guests, I want to put a little context in the discussion here. And I guess the theme is, can we count on the Democrats to stop Trump? And not just Trump, because really what Trump represents is a sharp rightward authoritarian, maybe proto-fascist shift going on in the politics and social structure in this country. We are at a critical juncture here. Can they stop it? Well, they haven't done so well so far. If they don't stop it, are they toast after 2020? What's the crisis, the political crisis at least? Because we know we got a health crisis, and we know we got an economic crisis. We've been talking about that, the economy slowing down again. As I predicted back in March, W-shaped recovery. Okay, well, that's a topic for another show. I want to talk about the political crisis here very clearly. And now even the mainstream media, you know, CNN and all the others are catching on. Robert Reich and all the liberals are catching on. Whoa, this guy means business here. He's going to wreck our whole capitalist democracy system. He's going to pull the plug. You know, he has no respect for any of it. All he wants to do is win. And he'll wreck the whole system. Well, you know, Thomas Friedman here from, New York Times. And we got Robert Reich and Paul Krugman. They're all raising the red flag, Beware, beware. Yeah, we got a power grab going on, no doubt here. Democrats unable to stop him with that joke called the Mueller report. I mean, as soon as Mueller was designated a special prosecutor reporting to the Justice Department instead of an independent prosecutor, it was all over. It was a cover-up. An impeachment. What a joke that was. Boy, he bar outmaneuvered the Dems real quick again. And now we got this constitutional fight going on, right? You know, Trump has said not simply that he won't honor the results, maybe, of the election, but he said, to his audiences out there, well, after we win maybe four more years, and then we'll look at another four. This guy's not going to leave office under any conditions. Yeah, I mean, if he wasn't so stupid, he'd be dangerous, you know? He gives the globalists a real entry here to pick him apart, right? And then Barr, you know, his Attorney General Barr, says, oh, protesters are traitors, treason in jail. You know, and Trump has said, they're insurrectionists. Yeah, they're preparing the ground here for protests that they expect that will erupt in December. They're already picking off some of the leaders for the protests already, you know. And the police are assassinating some of them, like this guy in Seattle, right? And police and right-wingers are getting together, scratching each other's back, helping each other out. We saw that in Wisconsin, right? Police are going on strike, you know? work to rule, whatever, slow down. They're all in Trump's camp. All right, so what is his strategy? His strategy is to stop the mail-in ballot vote count in the swing states. You notice I didn't say in the red states, because he says, oh, good, you know, Florida, mail them in, right? It's the swing states he's targeting, because this election will be determined not by the popular vote, because we have this idiocy thing called Electoral College. It'll be stopped by, well, it'll be won in 6 or 8 swing states, and that's what he's targeting. He's got his legal troops all over the place now, preparing the legal challenge and the grounds for stopping the mail-in vote ballot. Look, this is a real possible scenario. First, as a CNN poll just said last week, 66% of Trump supporters are going to go to the polls in person and vote. Only 22% of Biden supporters. And conversely, you know, 21% of Republicans will only do mail-in ballots. So what you could well see on November 3rd, 4th, is Trump appears to win. He has leads. He appears to win in these various swing states. Yeah. Of course, he could very well, probably would, lose if you wait for the mail-in vote count, mail-in ballots. But they'll stop the ballots. They'll try to stop the vote count. You know, exit polls will support, you know, his claim, well, I won on November 4th. Look, he'll declare victory prematurely before all the votes are in, and he'll try to stop the vote count, the mail-in ballot count. That's why all this talk going on about, oh, mail-in ballots are so bad, bad, bad. You know, it's not just Trump. This isn't just Trump. This is a whole organization behind him. This is Barr, all the other right-wingers in his administration now, and those behind him, the big capitalists behind him, you know, the Adelsons, the Mercers, and so forth, they're all for this. And he will get his Supreme Court third nominee appointed here, probably even before the election, but certainly afterwards. You know, and it's really something to watch the Democrats go through all these naive motions, saying, oh, you know, you said you wouldn't vote for a nominee in an election year, Lindsey Graham and all you other clowns. You said you wouldn't do that. And, of course, they're going to do it. I mean, the Republicans kick ass and take names, you know, and the Democrats, you know, they piddle around. That's why they get run over all the time. Oh, and then they say, well, oh, you know, we got Collins and we got Murkowski. There won't, you know, oh, all we need now is Romney. You know, well, Romney put that to bed real quick, didn't he? And then they say, oh, the military, Biden says, the military will move him out. Well, the Pentagon said, no, they're not getting involved. They cleared that up quickly. Oh, and then the Democrats say, oh, vote, get out the vote. Well, if you're going to stop the count, what the hell good is getting out the vote? Oh, and the big one is, well, you know, if we win and he gets his third person on the Supreme Court, we'll just stack the court, right? We'll get 3 more people to the court, into the court. You know, we'll add 3 more, our guys, to the court. Well, the Trump court will rule that unconstitutional. Yeah. And of course, that all depends whether the Democrats are going to win the Senate. But the vote count in the Senate is going to be stopped, too. The more it delays beyond January 20th, and it could very well, right, the stronger his position gets, particularly when you're going to see people in the streets in December and January protesting this. Oh, they're insurrectionists. Oh, you know what? They're traitors. And we're going to unleash the federal police force that we have now called DHS. Yeah, the executive has its own cops. Yeah. And the more chaos, social chaos, the stronger the argument will be for his Supreme Court to say, oh, we got to stop the crisis here and the chaos. Let's stop the vote. Can he do that? Well, they already did it in 2000 in Florida. You know, over 3 counties in 1 state. Stop the vote. Appointed, selected George W. Bush. Well, this is 1, 2, 3, 20, at least 6. Florida's coming. The question is, can the Democrats stop him? I don't think so. They've been proven inept and ineffective so far. And if they don't stop him, we're going to see a major political party realignment. And that brings us to the question of third parties. Which third party movement, or will they merge? Who knows? You know, in 2021 and after, will be able to displace the Democrats, perhaps, if they can't deal with this guy, which it looks like they can't. Well, let me introduce our guest today, the Labor Community Independent Party, LCIP, it's called. Been around here, you know, 6 months or so, doing some grassroots preparation, and they just had a conference here last week where they came together remotely, of course, and are planning the next steps. And we have two of the guests here who we're going to talk to. One is Myra Schoen, who is, I believe, on the editorial board of the group, and maybe it's newspaper, I'm not sure, and Connie White, who's an organizer for them. Myra, you here with us?
Yes. Hi, Jack. And,
hi, Myra. Connie, you here with us?
It's actually Maya.
Maya. Oh, Maya, not Myra. Okay. Maya.
Okay. Yeah.
Connie, you with us?
Unfortunately, Connie is ill, so I'm the only one here. And I want to say it's nice talking to you again. Oh, Connie, are you there? Oh, great.
Oh, do we have Connie?
No, we have Nnamdi Lumumba with us, who's one of the co-conveners of the Ujima People's Progress Party in Baltimore. He can tell you more about that, and he's part of the organizing committee for LCIP, the Labor and Community for an Independent Party, which Jack has been around for 2 years now.
Oh, and, okay. All right. Welcome, Nnamdi. Glad you could join us.
And also the Break the Grip two-day conference that we had was prepared by LCIP and the Ujima People's Progress Party and also the Labor Fight Back Network, which has been organizing for many, many years. It's labor activists organizing around many different struggles within labor.
Okay, so we got a coalition of parties and groups here, or parties in formation and groups that attended your last conference, I guess. Am I correct in that?
Jack, I guess I should start off saying something about what our objectives are and why we came together 2 years ago to form LCIP, Labor and Community for an Independent Party, because many of us are, and includes labor leaders, union activists, and community activists, many of us had been involved in the original Labor Party formation that had been spearheaded by Tony Mazzocchi in the 1990s, and eventually in June of 1996, 1,500 labor leaders and rank-and-file delegates from 7 union internationals and hundreds of union locals and regional union bodies, along with delegates from the community chapters that had been formed throughout the country based upon the organizing efforts, which was called Labor Party Advocates. And we came together in Cleveland, Ohio, to form a labor party. But the organizing, as you probably recall, was around the slogan, "The bosses have two parties, we need one of our own." And that was the rallying cry, the foundational organizing principle. And out of the convention, there was a tremendous program called the Call for Economic Justice that addressed many of the current struggles that we see today, the issues, the programmatic issues that still exist with us. But with all the organizing, there was still the impediment. And even though labor leaders had no illusions about how they've been betrayed by the Democratic Party time and again, they still refuse to complete the actual break from the Democratic Party. Even as they were confronting battles all the time between the corporatist ruling class, the corporate, the finance capital, in their day-to-day interactions as union leaders and defending the rights of workers, they still held to the old Gomper strategy of the original AFL. This was, award your friends and punish your leaders, your enemies. However, they never were punishing the Democratic Party when they didn't come through. And so it was become a pressure group on the Democratic Party. And as you're well aware, that space is occupied by all the numerous community and activist organizations throughout the country. So consequently, even though one of the unions, the International Longshore and Warehouse Union, the ILWU, of the primary internationals forming the Labor Party, and many of the union locals and the activists and the community chapters felt that the better strategy was to run candidates on our program within our local communities, that didn't come to be. There were many obstacles. And as a consequence, you can imagine, if you're not there in the electoral arena, promoting your message and gaining political power, the effort fizzled. So fast forward through all these years, given all that's been happening with all the struggles and all the rise and then also the disillusionment that many young activists had with Bernie Sanders, with how the Democratic Party placed obstacles, maneuvered to make sure he wasn't a candidate either in 2016 or, you know, or now, they became disillusioned and they too could look to see, is there another way? And what we as union leaders, union rank and file and community activists realized that we wanted a different approach. We wanted a two-prong approach, which then with the cooperation of NAMDI and the Ujima People's Progress Party became a three-prong approach. And the first concept was to lay the foundation of any mass working class party, not from above, but from below. That is, we weren't going to just be an accumulation of union internationals, which is be terrific to have them on board, but that we were going to build within our communities, and we were going to engage labor and the community organizations. That is, we're going to build a mass working class party that's rooted, absolutely rooted in the unions, in youth, and particularly in the communities of the oppressed who are moving and having a great upsurge. And that within our local communities, we would develop labor and community coalitions, and they would develop their individual platforms based upon the struggles in their communities in which they're engaged, and they would run independent candidates, independent of the Democratic Party, approved by the labor community assemblies that they hold, and that the candidates were answerable to these assemblies and to the coalitions formed. And that these were just not electoral coalitions, these are activist coalitions, whether it's defund the police, whether it's to end charter schools, whether it's to end the privatization of our public assets, whether it's whether it's power, water, or the land that's being sold off by the various communities. A second objective we had is based on the resolution that the labor unions adopted, the AFL-CIO adopted in its October 2017 National Convention, which affirmed, quote, whether the candidates are elected from the Republican or Democratic Party, the interests of Wall Street have been protected and advanced, while the interests of labor and working people have generally been set back. And then there was a second convention resolution that stated, quote, the time has passed when we can passively settle for the lesser of two evil politics. So in order for this not to just be a resolution that's passed by a convention, we want to see committees set up within our union locals that promote this. And a good example was given of how this can be done by Nancy Wolforth, who is the Secretary Treasurer Emerita of OPEIU, the office workers, and who was one of the primary people, along with Howard Wallace, starting in the 1970s, that promoted and developed and got adopted and part of one of the constituent groups of the AFL-CIO, which is Pride at Work for the lesbian and gay community. And what she said in elaborating how you do this is you start locally again, and you also start with a struggle. And for them, the struggle had been the Coors boycott. And they built local by local across the country within the unions until eventually they had such an overwhelming support that the Pride at Work became a constituent group of the AFL-CIO. So I think I've discussed two of our prongs about laying the foundation of a party. This is a long-term effort, Jack. We are not merging. We are not. We're discussing a building block approach of how you build a mass working class party and how you engage people in the very struggles that are taking place, bringing together all the struggles that are taking place in our communities. And I think Namdi is really best to articulate the third prong, which is a critical, and it's not separate from either of these two prongs. It's integral, but Namdi could really let us know about the third prong of what we're doing.
Well, Namdi, why don't you jump right in and tell us, Maya's given us a little bit of a history here that's interesting, I'm sure, to the audience here about there was a Labor Party, and we haven't talked about why it disbanded. Maybe we'll get into that. Because I think it has something to do with resistance from AFL-CIO leadership, which is, if I can inject my view here, allows these resolutions but does everything it can to prevent the resolutions from being implemented. Somehow we got to answer the question, why is it that as the labor movement, the union movement gets weaker and weaker, fewer and fewer members, why is it that they get closer and closer to the Democratic Party? I'm talking about the AFL-CIO leadership in Washington, mm-hmm. of course. That's a real problem. I mean, even under Obama, they threw the support for Obama because they thought they were going to get card check that would allow them to overcome this tremendous legal resistance by employers to organizing and unionizing. They thought card check was going to do it. And, the Democrats had the opportunity to pass card check. They had a supermajority in both houses the first 2 years, and they never even took it out of committee, And now Joe Biden, he's not even maintaining the fiction of a card check. But yet the Democrats are supporting him. The union AFL-CIO in Washington, the tops there are supporting once again. So, you got this argument when you say, and I guess I'm challenging a little bit here, when you say, oh, we're going to build the Labor Party based on the unions. Well, what do you mean by that when it's so obvious that the leadership of the unions is totally committed to the Democratic Party? Maybe you can answer that question in the course of presenting your third point here. I don't mean to prevent you from that. Please, go with whatever you think is your first answer.
Do you want to speak to that, Maya?
Yeah. I just want to quickly, because I really want to get to third, what I call the third prong, but it's really integrated in both. So it's not as if it's an exclusive third prong. Jack, I've listened to what you said. And first, I'd like to say that what I see in this country, because of the attacks by the capitalist ruling class very strong, there are two things among, with the gig economy and the Amazon and others, is the atomization of the working class. But at the same time, there has been an upsurge of labor organizing, as you saw with the Red State, the teachers' movements, which began not in a place like San Francisco or Los Angeles. It began in West Virginia. It began in the Red States and spread throughout the country, in Arizona and all places. And this was a mobilization. And at the heart of this were union members. There were the unorganized teachers, but there were the union, the kernel of union activists that really led the Red State and movement. And that teacher struggle had a great impact on people and to the support of union organizing. There also is tremendous union organizing among the unorganized, particularly in the workers who come from communities of the oppressed. Whether this is in the food and commercial workers, they're doing incredible in the meatpacking plants. And UE, the United Electrical Workers, is doing a big organizing drive. And what you say about the bigs, all you have to do is look at NAFTA and how Trumka went along with Nancy Pelosi in the NAFTA 2.0, the USMCA. The U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement, which is a complete sellout of labor. But listen to what we're talking about how you build a mass working class party rooted in our union locals, rooted in and union activists, rooted in youth, rooted in the communities of the press at the base. And throughout history, the changes that take place in our unions and the great union organizing drives all happen at the base. A union is only as strong as the commitment and the activity of the rank and file. And we are building, that is our intent, is to build the same way that we create union organizing drives, the way we create all social change. What you see with the upsurge of 20 million people in the streets after the assassination of George Floyd by the police is an upsurge from the base. It's not organized by any specific organization here and there. It's the people getting together in their communities and organizing themselves. Mobilizing in our own name is what the people who were involved in the Million Worker March coined that phrase. But it's the same principle, the same phrase that has existed from, the days of Joe Hill, the days of all the famous organizers, of even how the Teamsters were built with the Minneapolis General Strike, how the Longshore Union was built, how the Ladies Garment Workers Union was built. It all has to do with at the base, laying that foundation. And I think that's a good point, a good place for Namdi to then talk about what he, particularly in Baltimore, is doing and what the intent is.
Okay, Namdi, jump on in and give us what you got to say.
Yes, certainly. So, thank you, Maya, for that history. I think what's also unique is that there is obviously activism, daily work that happens in oppressed communities. I am out of the Black community in Baltimore. It is a city that is 66% African American. The city council is all Democrat. And the at the state level, even though we have a Republican governor, the Democrats run both sides of the House. But yet you still have a community that has high levels of unemployment. Almost 25% of our community lives in poverty, education problems, violence problems, you name it, it exists. And the Democratic Party, as a solution to these problems, has found itself woefully lacking. And so on the local level, oftentimes a lot of the activism is not geared at Republicans or conservatives per se, but at mainstream Democrats who essentially do nothing, right? We find them to be corporate politicians and pretty much doing the same things that have proven to fail Black and brown community. So the discussion is, how do you get these communities, which traditionally are very much lockstep with voting Democrat, but on the local level, a lot of the activism that happens in these communities are focused at people who are representatives of the local Democrat or state Democrat party. And so there's a question for us coming out of the work of before the Black Lives Matter movement. There was the Black Liberation Movement. There's the Latino movement, the Mexican Liberation Movement. These are forces that have consistently been on the front line of these kind of local kind of actions. They built coalitions all around the state, locally, you know what I mean, to be able to do the things that they do. Oftentimes, these aren't necessarily the well-covered discussions, but literally, these are the kind of organizations that do programs around housing, around providing food, health care, supplementing education problems. So there's a real track record and a real dependability that Black and brown communities have developed with these types of organizations. But these are not organizations that historically participate in electoral politics, especially as independents, right? It's just not the kind of thing that they sign up for. A lot of the work they do is always really geared at how do we solve problems right now. So for this third leg of what this LCIP is moving forward with is reaching out to organizers in those liberation movements, in these oppressed communities, being able to identify the fact that when you look at the Black Lives Matter movement, as Maya said, it's not being led primarily by any one organization or any small number of organizations. A lot of it's spontaneous. The struggles around deportation and immigrant workers' rights and families' struggles are ongoing. We've seen struggles with the indigenous populations around the pipeline. I mean, tremendous amount of resistance. These are real acts that are not necessarily focused at whether somebody is conservative or liberal, but these are policies that, regardless of which party is in power, disadvantage people of color, people in oppressed communities. And so how do you bring that energy into focus? How do you create a platform? How do you allow these folks who are very well proven fighters to be able to get access into the electoral arena and bring some of these struggles, right, to bear? How do people hear about them when normally it's only a community known thing, right? These are not necessarily statewide or regional wide discussions that are had. So that's where, forces like myself are very interested in this. We've been able to talk to political activists who are trying to build independent Black-led parties throughout the Northeast region, the Southeast region, and now in the Texas region of the country. These are places that have historically large populations of Black and brown people, percentage-wise, especially when you're talking about urban areas. We've had even real concerns from the Democratic Party about just the specter of a Black-led political party getting the ballot access, that there would be an exodus of especially young, working class registered voters out of the Democratic Party and into these kind of formations. And so that makes it very exciting for us that there may be a base of large base of people who are willing to not only vote for independent candidates, but structurally, organizationally, embrace a more left working class politic and some solutions to issues that have long been plaguing our communities, regardless of whether Democrats or Republicans are the administrators.
What is your organization's program? Is there a summary program? And if there is, where can people go to read, you know, what is your program? What are your objectives? What is your strategy? You know, can you give us a reference
listeners
can check it out?
Okay, so I should have said this at the beginning. For LFIP, Labor and Community for an Independent Party, we're an organizing committee. So there isn't a program, but we have a website with extensive material on it, and that is lcipcampaign.org, lcipcampaign.org. We also have email at lcip.campaign@gmail.com. And I think I've been told that you could just write lcipcampaign@gmail.com. And we've begun Twitter, which is the pound sign, capital L, capital C, capital I, capital P, campaign, the lowercase campaign. And we have Facebook at Labor and Community for an Independent Party. And the Eugene the People's Progress Party has a website, too, Namdi, if you want to give it out, your coordinates.
Well, you know, there are, if I can play devil's advocate again, you know, there are a number of organizations out there that are beginning to emerge and vie as an independent answer to the Democrats. You know, there's the People's Party, there's the Our Revolution group. There's even, I've spoken to groups in the Bay Area of young workers running independently of the Democratic Party for positions, local positions, and so forth. How do you distinguish yourself from them if you don't have a program?
Okay, I'm glad you asked that, Jack. First, I will distinguish from MPP, the Movement for a People's Party, which just had a big Zoom presence where they invited many Democrats, you know, and also... I forgot the wrestler who had been the governor in Minnesota.
Jesse Ventura.
Thank you.
Kind of a celebrity People's Party.
And yes, and where they also said, but I don't even know if they support the MPP, and where Carol Early, their political director, went on KPFA and said they don't care, left, right, whatever. But let's be clear. We are not a people's party. And I mean, we're a party of the people, for the people, but that is different than a people's party, which is a cross-class party. Let us be very clear. Our intention, and we're not a party, we're not evolving. We don't come out of, you know, the earth and as a full-blown party. This is from the bottom up. Labor and community in our communities, we form our coalitions. The coalitions themselves in each community form their platform in which they are going to run their candidates based upon the struggles that are within their community. As we have more community coalitions, we'll have a state meeting and state assemblies for coordinating. And then we might have regional assemblies, and then we'll have a national convention. We have to talk about democracy. A group, an organizing committee can talk about issues, and we do have many issues. Ralph Schoenman and I, for instance, in the process of building a coalition in Sacramento, we articulated many issues, the issues for discussions that could be part of a platform. But an organizing committee cannot elaborate a platform. The democratic process is that within our local communities, in Baltimore, there may be specific issues that the UPP comes up with that are critical for the platform in that community. In Oakland, there would be particular issues. I'll give you an example. In Adelanto, in Central California, the Latinos are faced with the problem that the Democratic Party has been supporting and the ICE concentration camp that exists there. And they are coming together, and Luis Angel spoke eloquently and in the immigrant rights workshop that took place at the Break the Grip, and how working with the immigrant community can bring them towards LSIP. They're thinking of forming a labor community coalition there and running candidates for their city council so they can throw out and defund the ICE facility. In prisons are put in communities across the state in California. The issues of defund the police. This is an issue that takes place at a local level. And this is how we come together.
If I can interrupt you, so what you're saying is that your, quote, programmatic objectives may be different in different areas and regions based upon the conditions in that area? I mean, I'm having a little hard time understanding how you run people for office without a program, saying, okay, this is what we're for, this is what we want to achieve.
Jack, you're still thinking from the top down.
No, I'm not. I'm talking about the bottom up. You know, I was an organizer for several unions for a number of years. And if I went and talked to a group of workers and I didn't tell them, this is what we're going to try to achieve, this is our program, they would walk away. You know, I'm wondering what you tell people that you're trying to organize, this is what we want to achieve.
Jack, I you know, there are many things, you know, a living wage. Everybody wants a living wage. We want public schools and public education. Many of these things are consistent within all our communities. We want a community control of the police. We don't want to be assassinated by the police. We want, you know, it can go on and on. The Labor Party itself had a long, you know, the call for economic justice. Many of which these things still exist today. We want the right to organize, bargain, and strike. We want our pensions. These are we want an infrastructure program. We want money not to go half of the discretionary budget in, you know, the federal government to go for the war, killing people throughout the world and preserving corporate interests. We want money within our states and within our communities. Within our communities ourselves, the local budgets, most of which goes for protect property, goes to the police. It's not going to fund schools. It's not going to fund mental health programs. It's not going for affordable housing. These are basic.
That sounds like your program. I mean, I'm wondering if you
I'm saying, I think almost everybody in all communities can agree on these basic issues, but it's not for an LSIP organizing committee to say this is a program for a party. That's what I'm basically saying. Namdi, do you agree?
Yeah, you're also looking at it maybe, again, in my sense, from the top down. Where LSIP is unique, and the reason why it's unique to some political forces like us, we're going to have a ballot access. We have a platform that we've put forward, and they very much overlap with what Maya has already said. So it's an easier answer for us to say because we represent a state, right, where there's a real presence for us to do that. LSIP allows organizations and organizers to have a network that we can really call upon. So as opposed to where you see, for instance, an MPP type of model right now, there is no capacity on the ground, right, for members in one part of the country to support a local candidate somewhere else in the country. I'm sure that that's capacity they want to build, but what we've done is we've allowed that to already be in front so that if we're running candidates locally here in Maryland, people who are tied into the LSIP program already can be able to say, hey, what can I do to help? What resources can we send people? Can we add expertise? Can we send resources? Those things are already in motion so that organizers connect to organizers to run in the electoral process. that's not something that new parties do right away.
Well, I think that's a very important distinction. You know, for the record, I've said many times I am for only a bottom-up kind of organizing of real people with real constituencies that eventually, you know, could come together and form a political party. I am not in favor of a top-down group of intellectuals declaring a party and going from there. So, you know, I think that's an interesting, useful distinction between the MPP and your organization. But, you know, it leaves me thinking that, you know, you're not really a political party yet. Am I correct in saying that?
Oh, yes, very much so. As I said, some of us have many, many decades of organizing. Some of us have a few years of organizing. But what we're using these skills, and it's important to know that in labor, many of the struggles that take place in our community are pushback. You know, when we, when, for instance, the call for ending tuition in City College, even though the Board of Supervisors in San Francisco is nonpartisan, these are Democrats, and they, you know, they're moving up the Democratic Party ladder. Up through all their positions. And there was a very strong community struggle to get tuition, end tuition at City College. And it stopped there. They were effective. They got it in place. But that struggle could have continued to elect our own candidates. The way we really build political power is in our own name. We have our struggles, like the massive struggles going on across the country in community after community of Black Lives Matter. We shouldn't be, people shouldn't be afraid to go in the street. They should have opportunities, and they should have opportunities in schools. All schools should be public, and all schools should be free, and all schools, and everyone should have a fantastic education. It shouldn't depend upon the wealth of your parents. So these are issues, and you can either push at the door of the corporate, the people who depend on corporations for their funding, or you can create your own political representatives who are beholden to you, who are of you, are beholden to you, and in your communities, you are then developing the skills for state representatives, national representatives, and so on. There'll be a lot of pushback. And that's what these labor activists who had a good idea of in their communities trying to get unions on board for electing people from labor unions onto the city councils. And they got a lot of pushback from the Central Labor Council, from the AFL-CIO. But they're running as Democrats. There have been people from unions in office. I always like to think of Dion Arana, who was the president of the Social Workers Union, then called 535, a statewide union, who was a big person, you know, what you call liberal Democrat in the legislature. And if you look at people who come from community, the head of the Black Caucus in Congress, she came from Los Angeles, from a very effective and important community organizing drive. But she is beholden to the interests of the corporations, as all the Democrats are. And you see that with what goes on, particularly with Nancy Pelosi pushing through NAFTA 2.0. And as you correctly mentioned, not having card check long ago. You can get, or even raising the minimum wage.
I think there isn't a living wage. I think most of the audience, you know, agrees with you with the problems here about the conditions and the Democrats and so forth. But I think they're probably more interested in trying to figure out what LSIP's strategy and tactics and structure is. You know, folks want to join something that's not so amorphous than let's just protest, you know, in the streets. They're looking for something that's that has some identity, organizational identity. What's your organizational structure, if you could share? Are you a membership organization? Do you have dues?
No,
do you join LSIP? Or do you just sort of join local Baltimore or whatever protests against, different conditions?
Okay, I'm sorry this is so hard to understand. LSIP is an organizing committee. As I stated, the objectives, and you can go on our website to see the objectives, and as Namdi has articulated too, people endorse. For instance, we have people from Helena, Montana, who have been, working in the public sector, who came out of the Bernie campaign and have understood, wow, in our community, we can really, we have the tools to organize and we can form a labor community coalition. I gave the example of the people in the immigrant rights who are fighting against deportation in Adelanto. A good example of how a labor community coalition could form in Oakland, for instance, you have for ILWU, Locals 10 and 34, you have an existential crisis with John Fisher's attempt and the city and the county ceding to selling off the Coliseum as private land, and then trying to take land at the port to build a new baseball stadium, which will disrupt all the
port activity. So people don't really join LSIP. Is that what you're saying? It's not an organization with membership or a structure?
Point,
how do you determine your leadership committee or whatever that determines what you're going to do next? I'm trying to figure out how you're different from the other organizations. I think that's what the audience wants to know. And, one of the questions is how are you different, if you are, organizationally? Is it a membership? Is there a structure?
Yeah.
Do you join a branch or a local group? Is there some sort of a leadership committee? How is that selected, et cetera?
Okay. Namdi, do you want to answer this? Or else I will.
Yeah. Certainly. So coming out of the conference that we did last weekend, a lot of those questions were being asked and they're in the process of being answered. There is going to be a permanent committee set up of folks to help really guide the process going forward. There's going to be an advisory committee as well that really leans on veterans of labor and community activism, people with several decades of experience to really help inform the day-to-day organizers. There is a desire and a need to be more structurally coherent. And so that's, again, that as Maya has put out the website, that is the way for people to start that process. We've tried to really avoid being top-heavy, right? And maybe at this stage it sounds like, oh, well, this is too premature. But the truth is that several rounds of candidates have already run. Several rounds of activists have already been endorsed and supported by LSIP. Again, like I said, there is a certain kind of flexibility in that structure that, unlike something that's more top-down, it takes a while for those things to get moving. There's a lot of agile agility in organizers being able to really connect in a network and be able to utilize the network of relationships, right? There is going to be a need for more structural coherence. And that's something that we're moving forward with that will probably be easier to talk about in the next 3 to 6 months.
Okay, thank you for that clarity.
I can add to that.
Let me ask you, we only got 5 minutes left here. What's next? What does your group see as next? If there is a major constitutional political crisis, which is increasingly likely here in November, December, and after, what do you see your group doing next, other than building itself organizationally, as Namdi just said?
Okay, so we just had last weekend the Break the Grip of the Two-Party System conference, and we have to come together, those of us, the three you know, late LFIP, LFN, and the GEMA People's Progress Party were coming together to evaluate. And as Nnamdi said, one of the decisions we've made is to have, again, an ongoing organizing committee, plus the addition of an advisory committee. And also we have other committees that, like our media committee, that can still move forward to get out the message. We are giving support for labor community coalitions that are people expressed that they would like to form in their communities, such as Adelanto. And there's a possibility in Yolo County, too, and Baltimore, of course. And there are other cities where this has come forward. So as to talk about the elections, Jack, this isn't a position, something that LSIP as such can itself put forward. This is going to come out of particularly among the unions and among the labor and of the people and the community groups in the streets. It's going to be a real quest for mass mobilization in whatever form, whether it's the forms of strikes, whether it's the forms of occupations, whether it's the other forms of dissent. I do have confidence that there will be, large-scale mobilization.
Okay. Well, we'll watch closely here.
Again.
And see what your response is, when the situation deteriorates here in politically in U.S. And I understand you're building carefully from the bottom up, but you also have a lot of folks who say we're running out of time, and I'm sure you're feeling that pressure from a lot of young folks. We need to do something now. We can't wait for a long-term development.
There is no dichotomy, but if you don't have a long-term perspective, if in 1996 with the incredible, the formidable, the massive energy that led 1,500 delegates to that founding Labor Party convention, if we were really attuned to this discussion and building in our local communities, like where I was living in Santa Barbara, where we had the labor unions themselves that wanted to run candidates for the city council, which particularly for the public sector union, SEIU, was imposing draconian cutbacks, and for the building trades union, which was imposing really restrictions on whether or not in public construction projects what would take place. They could have had a big impact by having many candidates running for that city council. We wouldn't be having this discussion now and saying, well, we need to start again. But you know how history runs. What starts out as a small mobilization and an idea and a kernel grows and expands and takes off and can have an incredible impact in a really short time. And that's our aspiration. So again, the website is lcipcampaign.org, lcipcampaign.org. And thank you so much for having us on. And thank you, Nnamdi. I know you had to be somewhere else. So thank you for making the time for being here, too.
Yeah, I'd like to thank you all for joining us. And it sounds like you're at the beginning of a process. So we'll certainly invite you back at some point and see, how far the process has gone along. This show is committed to giving opportunities to express the views and the objectives and strategies of independent political forces in this country. I am personally committed to independent politics. I don't believe that the Democratic Party will solve the problems we've got, which are worse than they've ever been. So we'll see how things develop here after the election, and hopefully we'll have you and some of your people back, as we will with some of the other groups, as we try to let people see the different choices here that are emerging. Okay, thank you again, and that will conclude our show today. I'm out of here.